Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are challenged on a whole host of fronts by the Chinese Communist Party. That's no secret to this audience. We cover it daily. The various lines of attack that they have waged against us constitute what they call unrestricted warfare. The damage that they have done to us is simply incalculable. It's the subject, of course, of our new book, The Indictment, in which we talk about the various ways in which the Chinese have done this damage to our country, aimed at destroying it, if they can. There have been relatively few good ideas offered as to what do we do about all of this. But the source of the best of those ideas, to my way of thinking, is my friend Roger W. Robinson. He's a man who served with great distinction in the Ronald Reagan administration as the senior director for international economic affairs on the president's National Security Council, in which role he played a decisive job of helping President Reagan take down the Soviet Union by using economic warfare techniques for that purpose. He has been pursuing tirelessly in the years since his service to President Reagan, the use of similar techniques to try to defend us against the next horrific totalitarian threat seeking the destruction of our country, namely the Chinese Communist Party. He has been the founder and proprietor of RWR, a consultancy that has now gone into other lines of work, but he has also been the chairman of the Prague Security Studies Institute, which he helped found. And in all of these roles, as well as chairman and ranking member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Commission, he has been a leading force in assisting the rest of us in understanding that our money is being used to make this mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party, more dangerous, and what we must do about it. Roger Robinson, it is great to have you back on Securing America, sir. It's been too long. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
I wanted to start by asking you about testimony you gave, as I recall, on May 17th before the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. It was, I think, the single most important opportunity you've had to sort of lay out, officially at least, the kind of dangers that are associated with our underwriting of this enemy. Tell us a little bit about the testimony, the message that you were trying to convey, and, its seeming effect.
Well, first, Frank, I'm very grateful to the chairman of that committee, Mike Gallagher, who has proved a visionary in the unrestricted warfare area, particularly the one that is most unsung, and in my mind, the most problematic, which can be summed up in two words, the money. We're not talking about just side change here. We're talking about trillions of dollars of a U.S. investor retirement and other dollar investments that have flowed into what they thought were benign investment portfolios run by Wall Street, into the coffers of the Chinese Communist Party, often via its state-controlled proxy companies, of which there are now some 5,000 in our marketplace, scooping up those dollars in order to finance the flagging of economic fortunes of China as we speak. There has been over 20 years of zero diligence being performed by Wall Street and by the U.S. government and its regulators in terms of trying to understand who these Chinese companies are that have been coming to our markets. Are they sanctioned? Are they human rights abusers? Are they national security violators of the type that are building advanced weapon systems for the People's Liberation Army? Not a single question asked, a complete free lunch program, and what I consider to be the greatest financial scandal in modern history, without doubt, whereby we've seen our democracy transfer trillions of dollars of funds under management to a totalitarian police state bent on our utter destruction, aided and abetted by greed-driven Wall Street firms, and what I'm sadly to report are conflicted top levels of the Treasury Department, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the National Economic Council. Now, this is the root of the problem and why we've had so little dialogue on the strategic implications of the money, and why we've done so little in terms of defending our interests. As we should all remember, money kills in the hands of totalitarian police state just as surely as weapon systems. And we've done nothing about it. Now, again, getting back to Chairman Gallagher, he has understood this problem as few in Congress have. He gave me a special opportunity with oral and written testimony, which I tried to use to the full, to lay out the facts of the case. This is not an opinion or ideological piece of work. It's based on empirical facts, and those facts, in my judgment, are irrefutable. And we have them all in one place and one time. And I'm gratified to say that they just didn't sit there gathering moss. In fact, Chairman Gallagher and the committee, on a bipartisan basis, have taken the initiative to launch a number of major forays into this field, the most recent being a letter to the chairman of BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world, $9 trillion under management, Larry Fink, and Henry Fernandez, the chairman of MSCI, which is the largest family of indices in America. They work hand in glove. MSCI is the index provider for the passive investment products of BlackRock. And as such, they are partners in what I'm sad to say are fiduciary malfeasance of the highest order that has been so deleterious to our human rights policies and our national security. He has taken them on frontally, and it is of signal importance, and it's the first time, I'll just say quickly, that the high, thick walls of Wall Street have been truly breached.
This is extremely heartening, Roger, because we have been, with our Committee on the Present Danger, China in particular, under your leadership, really, trying to raise the alarm about the damage that's being done here, specifically the extent to which we have seen unwitting American investors, pension funds, other savings, investments, and so on, sluiced, as you say, by the trillions of dollars to people who are seeking the destruction of this country, and in all likelihood will not be repaying those funds, especially if we find ourselves in a shooting war. It is extraordinarily exciting that the committee has now taken up an investigation, a formal investigation of these matters, looking at BlackRock and MSCI. And we have to take a short break. And on the other side of it, I want to ask you to sort of broaden the lens, talk a bit more about what they're up to and others as well that are detrimental to our national security interests. We'll be right back with Roger Robinson right after this.
The
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Joe Biden's deep familiarity with the U.S. Senate has evidently bred contempt for its constitutional role as the quality control mechanism for an international agreement with our enemies in Iran. For one thing, the Biden administration is not being transparent about the magnitude of the concessions it is making to the mullahs, including, according to published reports, giving them access to a further $20 billion. For another, the accord is not even being reduced to writing, so as to avoid having to submit it to the Senate for approval as required by law. Worse yet, such travesties are transpiring despite the Iranian regime's increasing belligerence, including attacking commercial vessels in the Persian Gulf and deploying drone and missile threats to U.S. naval assets defending those ships. This is no time to be rewarding Iranian belligerence or preventing the Senate from precluding such appeasement. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are visiting with Roger Robinson, a distinguished public servant, as well as a private sector analyst and, well, thought leader on the issues of financial security, a sort of subset of the economic warfare that he has specialized in, going back to Ronald Reagan's days, as a matter of fact. Roger, it's great to have you with us, and thank you for contributing to our understanding of what the problem is with Wall Street denizens like Larry Fink of BlackRock and Henry Fernandez of MSCI, and others to be sure, putting our money into Chinese Communist Party-controlled companies, including some working directly for the People's Liberation Army. They all do to some extent, but some are specifically supplying weapon systems with which to kill us. To the extent that this is now a subject of investigation by the Select Committee, these two companies in particular, what should they be looking for, and what are you recommending be done about it?
Well, in the first instance, Frank, over those 20 years I talked about, when these thousands of Chinese companies came uncontested, unreviewed, unscreened into the portfolios, investment portfolios of the American people, everyone imagined on Wall Street that the subject was so complicated, passive investment funds, A-shares, variable interest entities, all the jargon of Wall Street was used to confuse policymakers in the Congress or the executive branch and keep it in a world of what you once called the masters of the universe, those self-styled Wall Street mavens. And they did that very successfully. But now that more and more policymakers like Mike Gallagher are onto them, so to speak, they've fallen back to a much less enviable position, which is this: if it's not illegal, we're doing it, period. And right now, sadly, because of the dearth of proper legislation and a complete default on the part of the executive branch, for the most part, with some notable exceptions in the Trump administration, they now are in a position where they're still attracting companies that have been involved in all sorts of nefarious activities. Some that come to mind, like equipping concentration camps, aiding and abetting genocide, trafficking in slave labor, building the surveillance state, militarizing the islands in the South China Sea, building those hypersonic glide vehicles and aircraft carriers and advanced weapon systems for the PLA. In other words, all manner of bad actors in a totally non-transparent, non-fiduciarily sound environment of violation of U.S. securities laws by every one of those companies as we sit here today. No investor protection to speak of, And in this environment, they're still trying to defend themselves by saying, if it's not illegal, we're doing it. I think what the chairman and the committee have done on both sides of the aisle is to say, oh, no, you don't. There's going to be reputational damage. And there's going to be damage to your brand by your callousness and complete disregard, not just to human rights and national security, but investor protection. Everybody knows that the Chinese communists have now criminalized due diligence. They've just put out an edict in the last 2 weeks that says no more recording of material risks about China, because we're quite offended by the fact that you see us as a risk. I mean, the point is, the whole mechanism of informing investors properly so that they can make informed decisions has been out the window and has never been present and is at an all-time low in non-transparency right now. So these guys finally have a problem on Wall Street, a big problem. And this is just the beginning. It's going to move out from there to FTSE Russell, to Vanguard, to State Street, to Dow S&P. In other words, this isn't going to stop at BlackRock and MSCI. Finally, the lights are on.
And Roger, I wanted to ask you about one piece of this that I think you've really brought to the fore. You mentioned that there are thousands of Chinese companies that are in our markets. The last time I checked, there were only something like 240 or so that are actually listed on the New York Stock Exchange. How are the rest of these engaging in access to our capital markets and the savings and other funding of the American people?
Well, we have that very murky over-the-counter market that nobody seems to understand how it works, but the securities, read stocks and bonds of Chinese companies, are traded there. Gee, how many Chinese companies are there? Last time we checked, about 900 versus, as you pointed out, the 260 or so that are on the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. Then we have A shares. What are A shares? That's not so complicated. They're stocks that are traded only on domestic Chinese exchanges, Shenzhen, Shanghai, Beijing, period. They haven't been moved to Hong Kong or New York or Singapore or anywhere else, right? And so what happened was MSCI, who was pressured to do it by China, there's Wall Street Journal articles about this, you don't have to believe me, with arm twisting against Morgan Stanley and others, they forced the MSCI index provider to take their A shares, which are now multiplied into the thousands, right? And put them into the portfolios of the, well, first onto their indices themselves, which are slavishly then translated by asset managers into investment products, exchange-traded funds, mutual funds. That's where you and I lose our money, so to speak. Thinking unwittingly that these are all responsible investments from trustworthy fiduciaries, far from it. And so that's the way they got in the back door, completely unregulated, not non-compliant with U.S. federal securities laws, no material risk disclosure, no disclosure of their financials, which they regard as state secrets. Gee, I wonder how we're supposed to make a decision about a sound investment. Right? I mean, it's almost ludicrous to talk about.
Well, this is really the point, Raj, as you say, that neither the executive branch, the regulatory agencies, the Congress of the United States has required the kind of close scrutiny of these investments that's so clearly required, especially if, as has been the case in the past, we're supposed to have, you know, a protection of the investor top of mind in dealing with these kinds of situations. And that brings me to a last question, Roger. How is it that any of these Chinese companies are traded on our capital markets without being subjected to the same statutory and regulatory arrangements that do govern American companies, for example, and the others for that matter.
Scandalously, Frank, there is an explanation. In May of 2013, the SEC, the PCAOB, which is a subset of the SEC, and the equivalent in China, the China Regulatory Commission, cut a deal that waived federal audits of Chinese companies coming to our markets, a requirement that is absolute in the case of American firms and other foreign companies that are doing business in our markets. Who was it that was looking after the China portfolio during that period? Well, it was the Obama administration, and the China portfolio was largely handled by then Vice President Biden. So if we're wondering how those trillions moved and continue to move with no scrutiny as to where the money's going and how it's being used to our great detriment, that's a good summary.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. And thank you for the great work you're doing on the committee's behalf and so much more. God bless you. We'll talk to you again soon. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by the president of Geostrategic Analysis. His name is Peter Husey. He is a longtime denizen of the Washington swamp, I guess one might say, some of it in government, some of it monitoring what goes on inside government, and throughout really keeping the flame with respect to the importance of, well, for example, nuclear deterrence and being clear-eyed about the threats we face in that regard. Peter is a longtime friend. He's been a very active contributor to this program, for which we're always grateful, and we're delighted to have him back. Peter, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Enjoy being on your show always.
Thank you. Well, Peter, I think it's fair to say that subjects that we've cared about over the space of decades have suddenly gotten a lot more attention. Notably because of this new three-hour film titled Oppenheimer. I confess I've only seen the trailer, but I'm anxious to catch up with it, but also to get your critical review. What are your thoughts about the film? And you sort of look as though you're in the bunker yourself at the moment, which is quite dramatic, but give us your principal takeaways from it.
Well, it's something I studied a great deal in graduate school because I had a professor that was quite interested in the whole question of, could we have gotten Russia to agree not to build these crazy weapons? And the thrust of Oppenheimer, which is quite clever, is Oppenheimer was against the H-bomb in favor of the A-bomb, but he said, these things aren't usable on the battlefield, so why are we building the H-bomb? And then he says, well, yeah, I guess the A-bomb can't be used in a battlefield either. But he did support dropping the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He did support developing the bomb. But he then became very much for abolition. And certainly, it's not just arms control. He was in favor of, can't we show restraint and not build the bomb or only build a few, and then Russia will join us and we can go towards a much more stable. So he blamed America for starting an arms race. You've heard that many, many times over the last 70 years of every time we start building up to basically maintain parity, we get accused of starting an arms race, which is what this film fundamentally is all about, that restraint brings peace. And they really make Teller look bad because he was the kind of father of the H-bomb. And they make Leslie Groves, who was head of the Manhattan Project, but mainly Strauss, who's the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, of personal vendetta against Oppenheimer because he was in favor of the H-bomb and not and against the H-bomb. Okay? And so they kind of draw in, the reviewers have drawn in McCarthyism, because the thing about Oppenheimer is he had some very close friends, including a mistress, a wife, a brother, and Klaus Fuchs, all of whom were communists. And it's not that he was a communist, but he flirted with these people and seemed to be oblivious to, wait a minute, this is, you're building something that the Russians would love to build, which they did. And so that gets kind of swept under the rug as, oh, it's those right-wingers and McCarthyists. You know that theme. You've heard that throughout. Okay.
Rather frequently in the course of my own career, of course. Indeed. Peter, let me just say, to level set here, of course, Oppenheimer was the lead scientist in the Manhattan Project. Leslie Groves was the guy who organized it and ran it.
Right.
Edward Teller was in the mix, I guess, not so much with the Manhattan Project, as I recall, but subsequently became a driving force behind the development of the hydrogen bomb, as you call it, the H-bomb. So some of these are bureaucratic rivalries and the like, but it all took on this, this overall thrust of the nature of our security posture and whether it should rely on peace through strength, I guess one would call it, having these weapons, being able to brandish them to deter conventional aggression, for that matter, not just nuclear, or whether, as you say, arms control or even simply self-restraint would secure the peace. And it is your sense of the film that it left the viewer with the idea that Oppenheimer was right, that if we'd simply foregone these weapons, the world would be a safer and more stable place.
I'm not sure whether forego the nuclear bomb, but if we had not gone forward with the H-bomb and sat down with Russia and said, hey, look, we can come to some kind of, you know, and they downplay what was the threat in 1945, 46, 47, 48 with Russia. This was serious stuff. Mm-hmm. And they minimize that and make it look as this, that Teller and all the other opponents of Oppenheimer were not just right-wingers, but they were, to what extent will U.S. restraint during the Cold War and when USSR was around, to what extent can we, they call it jumpstart arms control or move toward disarmament? Now, Harold Brown, as you know, was former Secretary of Defense under Jimmy Carter, and he put it very well. He said, we build, they build, we stop, they build. And that, Dave Trachtenberg, one of our colleagues at the National Institute for Public Policy, wrote a monograph on this about a year ago, in which he looked at the entire history of the Cold War and the arms race. And he said exactly what Harold Brown said, is that the Russians and the Soviets, now the Russians, just continue building and they don't stop. Even when they've completed a program, they start all over again. And the difference is between what assumption do you make about Soviet behavior? Reagan's entire philosophy was he made assumptions about what he called the evil empire, because he said, these are not people that are ordinary, like Canada or England. And that's the difference in the perception of people in Hollywood, is that if we all just sit around the table and, you know, sing Kumbaya, that's probably not fair, but it's restraint and showing peaceful intentions. As Angela Codavilla used to tell me, said, that gives you the appearance of your superior morally. And Oppenheimer played in that game. And the movie tends to not take seriously those people that had real, turned out to be actually accurate problem with the Soviet Union. And now it's China.
Yeah. Peter, let me just ask you, because the whole theory of restraint is that the other side doesn't want to have superiority, does not want to have any capability that they can conceive of. And of course, in the event, espionage was important to the Soviets getting access to our nuclear secrets, atomic and hydrogen. But is there any evidence that had they not had that technology boost, if you will, that they would have foregone pursuit of those advanced capabilities?
No, the history here is pretty clear. They grabbed as many German scientists as they could, and they were involved in espionage to try to find out what we were doing. And Klaus Fuchs said, well, the reason he gave the Soviet Union the secrets, he said, I didn't want to have America to have a monopoly on such a weapon. And the issue here is, this is very fundamental. That is, if you really think the Russians are not interested in using nuclear weapons for coercion, blackmail, and in the case of Escalate to Win and Mr. Putin in Ukraine, would they actually get reckless enough to use them, then get rid of your weapons unilaterally. If you really think, and a late Bruce Blair used to say this, we don't need to respond to a nuclear attack with a nuclear weapon, we'll use conventional. And he said that a number of times during congressional testimony. And if you really believe that, then why do you have nuclear weapons if they're not usable? But that when pressed, they don't go that far. So then the question is, well, they really do deter, don't they? And if that's the case, abolition becomes dangerous.
And so would this pursuit, I would argue, of the so-called global zero.
Well, absolutely.
We've had all kinds of eminences, including Henry Kissinger, profess to think is the way to go. Was that sort of the thrust of Oppenheimer, that the world can get to zero nuclear weapons at this point? I mean, in contravention of all of the evidence to the contrary, from not just the Russians and their commitment, but now the Chinese big time, the North Koreans, the Pakistanis, Indians, and so on.
Well, it's what the producer and the writers decided to fudge some of these issues. They give the strong sense restraint will breed restraint. America started an arms race. That was bad. None of it was necessary. Okay? They say it could have been avoided. And the message is that the modernization today is much too aggressive. We don't need all these nuclear weapons. But it's step one is moderation and restraint. And, well, do we really need 3,000 warheads, 1,500 warheads? Let's go to some reduction, and then we can go to disarmament. But Oppenheimer turned out to be right, because Lyndon Johnson, you know, forgave him for his supposed sins and gave him a security, you know, said you shouldn't have lost your security clearance. But the story of how he was cavalier about his way he worked and the threat that he wasn't someone who said, oh, the Russians aren't a threat at all. But he wanted to be on the side of the angels.
Yeah.
And I think that, Frank, is where that narrative is very seductive, and it's very attractive. And people say, I want an alternative to, oh God, do we have to build these weapons? Do we have to deter?
Right. It always comes down, it seems to me, remember the old Crosby, Stills, and Nash song, Love the One You're With. It's always disarm the one you're with. And that turns out to be us. And the disarmament in the face of the abiding determination, not only to have nuclear capabilities, among other things, by the way,
well, but Frank, also it's interesting
to continue to modernize them. Peter, we are hard out of time, I'm afraid.
Okay.
I'm sure it is interesting, and we'll have you back on to share that with us.
Sir.
But thank you for your insights into this film, Oppenheimer. I'm going to go see it, and I hope others of you will take aboard Peter's review.
Thank you, Frank.
When you do.
Take care.
Thank you for joining us. Come back soon, folks. And until then, go forth and multiply. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Joe Biden's deep familiarity with the U.S. Senate has evidently bred contempt for its constitutional role as the quality control mechanism for an international agreement with our enemies in Iran. For one thing, the Biden administration is not being transparent about the magnitude of the concessions it is making to the mullahs, including, according to published reports, giving them access to a further $20 billion. For another, the accord is not even being reduced to writing, so as to avoid having to submit it to the Senate for approval as required by law. Worse yet, such travesties are transpiring despite the Iranian regime's increasing belligerence, including attacking commercial vessels in the Persian Gulf and deploying drone and missile threats to U.S. naval assets defending those ships. This is no time to be rewarding Iranian belligerence or preventing the Senate from precluding such appeasement. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and we're pleased, as always, at this point in the week, generally, with the opportunity to speak to Bill Walton, a recovering master of the universe on Wall Street, a man who has, among other things, become a prominent figure in the conservative movement in our nation, as well as a very engaged philanthropist, as well as dedicated public citizen, I think it's fair to say. And he's a man of many, many parts, and we're always happy to have a chance to tap his insights, as well as those that he generates in the course of a terrific television podcast that he does, The Bill Walton Show. And Bill, it's good to have you back to do all of that and more. Welcome.
Frank, great talking with you. Thanks for the praise.
It's well-deserved, honestly. Yeah. Bill, a lot to talk about and not a whole lot of time. Let me start by asking you about something that the committee chairman of the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party of the House of Representatives, Representative Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin, has addressed with the Biden administration recently, which is this sweeping umbrella agreement called the Science and Technology Agreement between the United States and China. I think we touched on it a little bit earlier with our friend Gordon Chang, but I'd be very interested in your views on the advisability. Mike Gallagher is taking a dim view of it, but your thoughts on whether it's wise for the United States to be continuing to use this as a mechanism for, it seems, the wholesale transfer of both scientific information and know-how, as well as technology, to the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, Mike Gallagher is exactly right. This agreement, it's called the U.S.-China Science and Technology Agreement, STA, as we fondly call it, was inked back in the dark ages of our relationship with China, when we really had no idea what they would get up to over the course.
We were in the dark.
We were in the dark. Sure. They probably were making plans, as they always do. Anyway, 1979, when it was first agreed to. And the idea back then, as we all know, was that the United States is going to help China with technology and markets and investment. And we're going to make China come up to speed with technology and its market economy and make them safe for democracy. Well, just the opposite has happened, of course. The Chinese Communist Party took this agreement and used it every which way to Sunday to exploit our technology know-how. And the agreement is at the State Department level, but each agency in the United States government that has anything to do with research also has sub-agreements with these. And you know, they're giving permission to lab to lab, university to university, scientist to scientist cooperation. And this has been ongoing for almost 35 years. And it has got to stop, particularly now that we have a very gimlet-eyed view about China's true purposes.
China, and rightly so.
Well, yeah.
It hasn't exactly worked out as we were thinking it would in the Dark Ages.
It's worked out for the Chinese. I mean, yeah. The thing that wasn't contemplated then is now the Chinese are, it's hard to measure ascendance, but there are people saying that in artificial intelligence, quantum sciences, biomedicine, space warfare, which wasn't on anybody's radar screen in 79, now is, and we've given them an awful lot of technology, and we've created a formidable competitor. And nothing in this agreement was envisioned to deal with that sort of thing. The Chinese, of course, would very much like to keep this agreement. The Chinese ambassador to the U.S. was at, of all places, of course, the Aspen Security Summit, which I think is Davos West, saying that they'd very much like to renew it on the basis of equality and mutual benefit. That's not a trade that we can make, and it's time to shut it down.
I think it's fair to say, Bill, that if we do in fact see the Chinese now enjoying advantages in a host of these technology areas, they're unlikely to be transferring that information back to us, don't you think?
It's a one-way street, Frank. Yeah. Absolutely a one-way street. Yeah. And this really brings into high relief or high focus just the divides in the Biden administration and maybe the rest of us. Janet Yellen is still saying this is a terrific agreement and that we're overstating the effect on the technology transfer. And, you know, she's a complete dove when it comes to China. And I think my fear is that Anthony Blinken, who, of course, was getting paid roughly $1 million a year by the Chinese to run Joe Biden's foundation before he became Secretary of State, is conflicted on China. And so our China interest, our interest to protecting ourselves from China in this administration, are severely compromised.
No, they are. You know, I was going through Michael Pillsbury's book, The 100-Year Marathon, recently, yeah. Bill, and it's an interesting book in a number of different respects. Notably, the chronicling of the extent to which we have been massively transferring yeah. information, yes. technology, scientific data, and technology and technical expertise, and so on, to the Chinese over a very long period of time. And in fact, he's talked about in public the large number of representatives of these various government agencies based in the embassy in Beijing, whose job it is, even now, to be promoting this kind of transfer of information and technology and so on. And it just boggles the mind that we're this out of touch with the military and strategic realities.
Yeah, part of the problem, Frank, is that the scientific community does not see the national security problem. I mean, they're all in to discover new things, invent new formulas, all that sort of thing. And so the scientific community is up in arms, and they can't believe that we would end this form of cooperation. It's time for us to think about something else besides their curiosity and their new inventions, which if we give them to the Chinese, they would use to kill us.
You bet they will, indeed. Bill, we got to take a very short break here for a moment, but when we come back, I want to ask you about some developments on the Chinese economic front that suggest that Xi Jinping's industrial and economic infrastructure is coming apart at the seams and what the implications of that might be. We'll be right back with that and more with Bill Walton right after this. We're back, and Bill Walton is still with us, I'm happy to say. Bill, we were talking earlier about some of the ideas that are afloat in terms of trying to, well, help keep the Chinese government afloat, I think it's fair to say. very ill-advised ideas like this science and technology agreements renewal, I wanted to turn to some other evidence of the difficulties the regime is having economically at the moment, and your sense of whether we should be encouraging those problems or alleviating them.
Well, we should be alleviating problems if we're sharing technology with China. But Frank, I think investors may have been watching our show. As you know, we've been covering the hostility that Xi has shown to outside money, doing things like shutting down due diligence firms, disappearing billionaire tech entrepreneurs inside China, and basically taking the entrepreneurial economy that was there and shutting it down if he can. Well, investors noticed that. And what's happened in the last quarter is that foreign direct investment into China from all sources have dropped to $20 billion. Now, that sounds like a big number, but that's down from $100 billion in the same quarter a year ago. And the other thing, people are voting with their feet, or they're voting with their feet to stay where they are. Foreign visitors to China numbered about 52,000 in the first quarter of this year, and that's down from pre-pandemic numbers of 3.7 million people in the quarter. So it's a dramatic change. Now, a small
which has impact on tourist dollars, tourism, and all the rest of it.
You know, Apple used to have 100 planes. I think I exaggerate, but only by a lot. No, they had like 250 seats reserved every day to fly their engineers into Beijing to work on joint technology initiatives, and that's all been shut down. So it's scientists going into China, it's tourists going into China. A lot of it, though, is local. You know, China's policies have not made a lot of friends with its neighbors. You know, China suffers a dramatic shortage of water, and they're beginning. But China also controls the headwaters for most of the rivers that provides water to Southeast Asia. You know, most notably the Mekong. And they're beginning to put dams up and try to control the flow of water to their neighbors. It's not good neighbor policy. They're noticing, and people don't want to go to China.
When you say control, I think that's generous. I mean, it's basically deprived them of water downstream from those dams that is vital to life in those countries, not just their economic well-being.
Absolutely. And Morgan Stanley, I find there are two aspects of this. One is Morgan Stanley taking a look at the unemployment and the catastrophic real estate overinvestment in China and some of the other investment problems has downgraded China to 13 out of 28 countries in its, quote, developing nation roster. Now, it's interesting that Morgan Stanley still considers China a developing nation when its economy is almost as big as the United States, but who knows? Who knows what my friends on Wall Street think, how they develop, how they consider developing.
I think Morgan Stanley helped set up MSCI time ago. It's now spun it off, I believe. But Bill, MSCI, this index fund that's widely used, and BlackRock, one of its principal enthusiasts, have now both, we were speaking about Mike Gallagher earlier in the program, been announced to be under investigation by that House Select Committee. To the extent that these outfits are continuing to try to prop up the Chinese Communist Party with our money, that seems long overdue to me. What do you make of it, and what do you think they're likely to discern in the course of that investigation?
Well, this, Frank, once again, this is something you and I were talking about almost a year and a half ago, and thanks to the work of Roger Robinson and you and some of the other people and
Committee on the Present Danger of China, which you're a member.
You know, this Morgan Stanley Index is a way to include Chinese companies in U.S. investors' portfolios, and most notably the federal pension funds, U.S. government federal pension funds of government employees has been invested big time in Chinese companies through this index. And we've been working to have them strip the Chinese companies out of the index. They have the means to do it. It would take you know, I know that I know you, if you know your way around a spreadsheet, and I do, it would take about 10 minutes to purge it of Chinese names, but they're saying it's way too difficult. Well, I think what Mike Gallagher's doing is exactly right. And it's not just the Morgan Stanley Index, but BlackRock and the other major investment houses don't really want to see any change, because once again, BlackRock, JP Morgan, the other financial houses still long for that big Chinese market, the trillions and trillions of dollars of investor savings in China, and they'd like to make some money managing it. So BlackRock is keeping China close, and I guess they're not keeping us closer. They're still pushing us away.
Yeah. Well, it's our money that I wish they were pushing away rather than getting more of it.
They're economic actors, Frank. They're economic actors.
Well, they are. But we need a political decision made here to prevent that sort of thing from happening, I think. Bill, speaking of political, you had a very important conversation on your program, The Bill Walton Show, with Robert Lighthizer recently, a longtime leader on trade with China, Donald Trump's trade negotiator, among other things. He had some interesting comments about the Chinese and Joe Biden. Can you recall those for us?
Well, you know, Bob is a fascinating man. He's been involved in the trade wars for over 40 years as a lawyer. He was Ronald Reagan's assistant U.S. trade representative, and he was for all 4 years Donald Trump's U.S. trade representative. And Bob has been to China many, many times. He sat across the table from President Xi and all the top economic and trade officials in China.
We're almost out of time, Bill. What did he say about Joe Biden? Quickly.
He said, you got to be careful because China has all the records on Joe. They have the bank account locations offshore. They've got the numbers of the accounts. They've got the records of all the phone conversations.
They own his cufflinks, I think, is another way of putting it in Washington terms. Bill, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you for your time, my friend, as always, and for your insights on all of these issues. We value them very greatly, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. We'll be right back with more.